Up next is Adam Adams talking about the NBA Finals and a whole bunch of other topics happening around the NBA. That's coming up now with Adam. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We just watched the Oklahoma City Thunder win game two of the NBA Finals against the Pacers, 123-107, all tied up, 1-1. To talk about it, here's Adam Mattes. How are you doing, Adam? What's going on?
What's up, brother? How you doing? Not the most exciting game two, but, you know, we'll get through.
Not the most exciting game two at all, Adam, but we are tied up 1-1 in the series. And I felt like the big difference in my eyes between this game two and game one, it made me think about who Indiana beat to get to this point. When they beat the Cavs and they beat the Knicks, I never felt like Cleveland or New York really ever matched Indiana's speed, physicality, relentlessness, like start to finish in games. And there's a mental aspect to that in addition to the physical aspect with endurance and strength and speed and toughness. Like you need to be mentally locked in to play the way Indiana does. That's hard to do. And I felt like OKC did that in game two tonight. And the two plays at the end of the third quarter, I thought, summed it up. 26 seconds left. Mathurin grabs a rebound. Toppin and Bryant and Nesmith are running the floor hard. And everybody on OKC sprinted back into the quarter. SGA hustles back, strips Mathurin from behind. OKC gets the ball back, scores, goes up 19. And then the next play down the floor, Cason Wallace, that's when he blocked Nesmith in the corner, who caught the ball when Nesmith was still at like the free throw line extended, and just the absurd closing speed to block the shot there. I felt like those plays of many summed up how OKC just matched that relentless intensity that opponents so rarely ever do against Indiana.
Yeah, there's no question. And we saw some of that in game one. You know, they were able to go to it. It's what makes both of these teams so special, in my opinion. Indiana's ability to execute with incredible precision and intensity over 48 minutes on the offensive end, and Oklahoma City's ability to do that on the defensive end. And when either team loses sight of that for even just a couple of seconds, then they become much more vulnerable, much weaker. It's that skill, their ability to execute that with those tough rotations that make them what they are. We saw moments in game one where Oklahoma City lost control of that. Indiana made a big run. And we really saw, I mean, this game, as much as Indiana played poorly, it's the run you're talking about. That was the game. Like, that was the 17-2 run. It ended up being a 20-point game. And in that moment, Oklahoma City's execution defensively, their speed, everything was just unbelievable, and Indiana didn't match it. The game opened up, and then the rest of the game was just trying to play catch up. So yes, it's the defining trait, in my opinion, of Oklahoma City.
Yeah, and ultimately, man, like, if they're going to continue that throughout the series, which in times, like you said, we saw that in game one, but that's where OKC has that ability to play with a lot of guys on their roster. Indiana's depth is partially what allows them to play that way. OKC goes deep, man. Like, we saw AJ Mitchell in game one. We saw Kenrich Williams tonight in game two. And it turned out that it was really like Aaron Wiggins with 18 points, Alex Caruso with 20 points, huge games off the bench for the Thunder. Those two guys scored more than every Pacers player. Haliburton at 17, yeah. He was the highest scoring player for Indiana. But OKC's bent depth guys did step up for sure.
I didn't even realize Haliburton ended up the high scorer. That's kind of funny based on how the game went. But you're right. So here's Oklahoma City, right? They have Shea every single night. He's a metronome. He scores on everybody. He gets his buckets. You usually get contributions from Chet and J-Dub tonight. You, of course, got it. But it's like they will have to get 1.5 or 2 contributions, but they have 9 guys to pick from. It could be Dort, Cason Wallace. It could be Hartenstein, Caruso, Wiggins. Tonight it was Wiggins and Caruso who combined 9 of 16 from three. And if you get that from two guys, you're just not beating them, because what they do on the defensive end is so consistent. If they just get one or two of those role players to make their shots, it's going to be a 20-point win.
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately, like you mentioned it with Haliburton, it's hard to believe he ended up their leading scorer. He had 5 points entering the fourth quarter. And I'll tell you what, Adam, you know, Indiana's not going to win this series if Halliburton's waiting until the fourth quarter every single game to get going as a scorer. He needs to get it going earlier in these games. I know he has an epic game winner in game one, comes up clutch down the stretch. We know what he's capable of doing. Sometimes if you say he needs to score more, you end up looking stupid in the end with him. But I really do feel that way against the Thunder. Like, Halliburton's got to find his shot earlier in these games, or Carlisle needs to design more for him earlier in these games, because he's too elite as a three-point shooter, too elite as a mid-range shooter, and he's capable, at least in the floater range, if he's not getting into the basket, for him not to get the amount of shots that I think is going to be required for the Pacers to win the series. Do you feel the same way?
I mean, there's no question about it. And I think here's the hard part for players like a Tyrese Halliburton, who they feel the game. They want to read it. Okay, what defense are you given? How do I maximize that? Get it out of my hand if you're trapping me, whatever. But OKC is good enough to both force you to make the read or to be less aggressive, get the ball out of your hand, but they're also good enough to recover from it. And I think what we've seen from Oklahoma City as these series have gone on, we saw it from Anthony Edwards. We even saw it from Nikola Jokic. If you remember games, you know, 2, 3, 4, Jokic was a little passive. We were wondering, why is he not being more aggressive? You almost get to a point with Oklahoma City where you realize they're going to try to get the ball out of your hand and you have to go through it. And I think he sort of figured that out. They gave him a little more space late in the game where they would try to get him moving into the catch so that he was going downhill when he would attack. So there are some things I think Indiana can do to open it up. But I think more than anything, the right play against 28 teams is different than the right play against Oklahoma City, because nothing's open. So you're going to have to be aggressive and you're going to have to drive into traffic and try to get to those float shots. He hit a couple in the fourth quarter tonight that were pretty tough. That's just Oklahoma City's not giving you A-plus looks. You're going to have to find a way to get B-minus ones and just be aggressive consistently.
I think that is spot on, Adam. You said it. Like, what might be the right play against 28 other teams always isn't against the Thunder. Like, that is just 100% exactly hitting the point that I am here with Halliburton. It's like, you want to make the right play, and he does that. Like, he obviously limits turnovers. He's a savant playmaker. The dude's brilliant, and he's clutch. Like, we know what he's capable of doing. With him, it's just like, sometimes I just wish it would come earlier in these games where you would feel him in these games. Like SGA, I thought it was crazy. He was getting criticized for taking 30 shots in game one. I understand, like I get like the people saying like, okay, so he had like a season low in passes per game, but like the game changes. And like, sometimes your best players need to just be taking B minus or C plus shots, especially when in game one, Chet and Jalen Williams, there were nothings out there with Halliburton. Yep. In some of these games, like, I wish he would take 10 first quarter shots to really set a tone for his team. And sometimes he might hit 8 of those shots. He might only hit 5 of those shots, but that might be for the benefit of your team. And like I said, the 3-point shooting, sometimes you're not going to be able to get that off. And sometimes he's not going to be able to get all the way to the basket, but the dude is a 50% guy from mid-range, and that's there for him all the time with those pull-ups. And I think in these games, in the finals, that's where I wish he would exploit the mid-range. I think it's there for him, Adam, and maybe at some point in the series we'll see it.
And it's kind of a razor's edge, though, for both guys, for both Shea and for Halliburton. You can take 15 shots and be super aggressive, and you could take 25 shots and be a little too passive. It's not just go out there and try to force some things. It's an understanding and an acceptance that you're not going to get the first or second options. It's not going to be easy. There's going to be fewer possessions than ever where it's like pass, the beautiful game, pass, wide open shot, and it works. Those just aren't opening themselves up because that Oklahoma City defense is so good. So you have to turn the dial and kind of go into it mentally knowing, I'm probably going to have to take 1 or 2 shots a quarter that I don't usually take, but I have to figure out when the right moment is to go and attack him. And to Shea, I didn't hear that. It's funny, man. Everybody's on different internets. There were people criticizing Shea for being too aggressive. Is that what it was?
Yeah. Yes. I saw some of that on my timeline. I did. I saw some of that on my timeline, and some of it hilarious. Like in my mentions and DMs, maybe because on my pod on after the game that night, it did say, I commented on Doris Burke's comment where during the podcast, she said SGA is being over aggressive, which, you know, I respect Doris, but I thought that was an absurd statement considering the nature of that game and what it felt like OKC needed. And in this game, SGA, 21 shots. He had 12 free throws. I thought he was pretty much equally as as aggressive as game one. It's just OKC gave him more support. And also, I do think Dagnalt did move SGA around the floor a bit more. Plenty of people on social media did note that SGA got more screens at the logo that gave him more room to split pick and rolls. There was a instance where he split a pick and roll like middle of the third quarter. Hartenstein was on the short roll, caught it, found Caruso on a cut. And then the next play after that, I remember, you know, you mentioned that like sometimes there's not a lot of those Spursian level plays, but SGA was posted up on the left block, drew a lot of attention, kicked it out. OKC swung it around the horn, found Caruso wide open in the corner for a three. So I thought the Thunder did a really good job of putting SGA in different spots on the floor in order to keep things always feeling fresh for the Thunder on offense.
He's had higher scoring games in this playoffs, but I thought this was one of his better overall games at just getting the ball, putting the defense in the spot he wanted to, and then making the right read. Sometimes it was aggressive, getting to his spots and hitting his mid-range that it feels like he never misses. But sometimes it was just collapsing it, and the exact play you're talking about, you don't get an assist for it or anything, but you drove the defense into the right spot, and you trust the swing, you trust your role players to knock them down. And it is funny, man. This is just basketball in 2025. Caruso made those shots tonight, 4 of 8. He was hitting all of them, it felt like. I mean, 4 of 8, but he was hitting the ones where the ball was swinging around or the kickouts that he needed to hit. You got 5 of 8 from Aaron Wiggins. And if those guys don't make it, the offense looks a little bit more clunky. When guys do make it, you're like, oh, the beautiful game. Everything's working. So I thought Shea was phenomenal tonight, doing what he was supposed to be to do. It opposite of Haliburton, it was a perfect example of a guy who was appropriately aggressive. Because he was aggressive, but to your point, it's only 21 shots. It wasn't like he took 30 of them tonight. He was appropriately aggressive, and guys helped him out by knocking down their open ones.
On the note of Haliburton, I do wonder if moving forward in the series, we're going to see his minutes tick up, because first quarter, he sits down, you know, late in the third quarter, Indiana's down 21-20, comes back in after 6 minutes and 43 seconds, and then they're down 40-27. So the Pacers were minus 12 in 6 minutes and 43 seconds without Haliburton in the first half. So almost 7 minutes without Haliburton. Then in the third quarter, Haliburton only took a 3-minute break. So I wonder if you'll see Carlisle moving forward in this series shorten some of the rest out there for Haliburton, because TJ McConnell's like a really good longtime backup point guard. Those are not quality minutes for him out there tonight.
It will be interesting to see. I mean, the next game, I think it's Wednesday and Friday, right, in Indiana. So you've had these 3 days off. Now it's just a 2-day break. He's young. It probably doesn't mean anything. He could probably play 40 minutes, take 48 hours off, and be fresh again. But that is the thing about Oklahoma City. It's actually the thing about both of these teams, and it's why I think the series is so fascinating. They are prone to runs. Oklahoma City in that 17-2 run, it was turnovers, fast break. It just happened so fast and so overwhelming. And even when Haliburton comes back in, it still took a couple minutes to really get things stopped. But Indiana knows this very well, because they do the same thing. When they get rolling, it's contagious, and it feels like it takes forever to slow it down. So Oklahoma City made that run today. It did come with Haliburton out. I don't know if it's just because of that, but Oklahoma City's so deep that at any moment they can deliver a knockout punch. They're great in the regular season. They'd bring Shea out and go with J-Dub, where J-Dub would be his most aggressive to start the fourth. And it was their superpower, because you just battled all game, and all of a sudden to start a fourth quarter when your stars are resting, they have this whole second group with stars that can lay a knockout punch. That's what happened in that second quarter.
Definitely. I mean, you're right. Like, it's not just Haliburton resting like that contributed to OKC being part of that run. It is worth noting, Haliburton has not played over 39 minutes an entire game this whole postseason, except the two overtime games Indiana had against the Knicks and against the Bucks. It's the only time he played over 39 minutes the entire postseason. So I do wonder if that'll change moving forward in the series. I saw someone post on social media tonight a stat that I want to get your thoughts on here. In the playoffs, the Pacers are now 13-0 when shooting 36 or better from three, and now they're 0-5 when shooting worse from three. Is that just simple shooting luck, Adam, or is there something deeper to that we saw again happen tonight?
It's probably a little bit of both. I mean, they were at 35% tonight, so they were like right there, and it wasn't close. Like, yeah, yes. If they would have made one more three, then this stat would have gone, you know, gone to hell, because they would have definitely lost even with one more three. But I think that my hunch would be that Indiana looks phenomenal when they're able to play their style of basketball. And so that number is usually, I would guess, the result of their offense working the way it's supposed to work. So it's almost like the execution comes first and then the result is made shots. That's probably how I would look at that stat. But Oklahoma City's the best at disrupting what you do. I mean, that's what makes them so special. That's what makes this matchup so interesting, is Indiana is capable of breaking it as well as anyone we have seen in the NBA so far this year. But they might not be good enough, as we saw tonight.
Yep, absolutely. Oh, I want to get your thoughts on the fact OKC went back to double big. Not a lot of it. I think it was maybe, we don't have the lineup stats yet, 6 or 7 minutes. I think I tracked it in the first quarter. They played 3 minutes and 36 seconds. It was just a handful of minutes after that. Played pretty even to Indiana. Do you expect OKC to go more to double big? And what were your initial thoughts after game one when they changed the starting lineup to put Cason Wallace in favor of Isaiah Hartenstein?
Well, I didn't think it was as crazy as most people did to change your lineup. I know that they won 68 games, but you kind of know going in, the whole point of your roster being 10 deep, and really they're more than 10 deep. They're like 12 deep. They just, every series, there's one or two guys that they cut out and put somebody else in. So that's what's so crazy about them. But the whole point of that depth is that you can play multiple styles, like the same identity, but with different people in different spots. Siakam is a big killer. When you try to play two bigs with him, he's a killer. So my answer is yes, I do expect Oklahoma City to use the double big lineup, and I expect it to be a problem for Indiana, but it'll always only be in the sport short bursts, because it has to be when Siakam's not on the court, or at least when he's wearing down and about to check out. So it's just another thing that Oklahoma City has in their back part. They have all these, it's like they have a good team, but they have all these extra cards they can play because of their depth. And that's one of them. We'll go to double bigs whenever Siakam's out, so that he has to get back on the court earlier than he wants.
One thing I want to go back to that you mentioned earlier, Adam, was SGA. I think you had said this is one of his best overall games you've seen him play over the playoffs, right? Or it was his best overall game, you said, right? Tonight, thought four steals, the defensive intensity from SGA as well. That gets back to my initial point that I had. Like, he had this play in this, like, I think the second or third quarter, where Siakam is switched on him and like posting him up underneath the rim, and Turner fired the ball inside, and SGA just like used his long arms, reached around, just snatched the ball out of the air. And I'm like, damn, like this dude is bringing it defensively every single play. And I thought, like, in addition to just how brilliant he was offensively, picking his spots, making all the right plays on the floor, limiting turnovers, he again showed why he won the MVP. Like, it was because of two-way play with his defensive performance as well.
Yeah, his defense was really solid tonight, as was the entire team. I almost feel like it's easier when the entire team is playing that way. Everybody's kind of getting a hand in the cookie jar and making plays. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking about this. Can I all get a little weird with you, Kevin? I always think about guys' build, because if you think about the NBA, almost every player has a physical abnormality. Right? Like really long arms, really big hands, or really high hips. I think Shai, he's really long, has really long arms. He almost has low hips. And the reason I say this is I saw a picture where they were previewing the finals, and it had Haliburton and Shai standing side by side, basically the same body, except for Halliburton's hips were like 8 inches higher than Shai's. And I remember thinking, like, that's really weird. But I think if you watch him play, he's always on balance. And it's almost like that helps him balance. And with his pivots, even with his defense, he just has this great, like, lower center of gravity than you would expect for his height. Is that weird?
No, I don't think it's weird at all, because teams look at stuff like that. It's like the biomechanics of how your body moves. Like, do you remember Miles Turner pre-draft? People said, like, he runs weird. Like, the way he runs will lead to football. He still does. Right. But he partially runs weird because he had a train to run weird. I think he runs weirder than he did when he was in Texas and in high school, because the league changed the way he had to run. Like, all of the stuff teams look at. So, no, I don't think that's weird at all. I don't think it is one bit.
I always think of, I think, well, who was it? man, guy out of UConn, a center. I can't remember who he was, where he was like 7 foot tall, but he had a neck that was like 9 inches long. And I remember thinking, he's not a real 7 footer. He's like a 6'6" guy, but this long neck that makes him 7 footer. It's just like those little things. Taylor Horton Tucker, right? Tiny little abdomen. And it almost makes him hard to guard because he's different from what you expect.
Was that long necked UConn center in the NBA at one point? Hillis?
Yeah. Is it Hillis? Was that it? Man, what's his name? I can't remember. I'm going to look this up.
I'm forgetting.
He's a coach now. No, that's the football player.
For anybody watching us live on YouTube or X, hit us in the comments if you know who Adam's talking about. I have like the face in my head. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but I know exactly who you're talking about. But you're right. Like teams do look at all of that. Those types of things. And like now, one of the things, you know, I'm looking at is like, you know, like shooting touch, how much of the, like the touch and the fingers is inherited by, you know, your parents, right? Like can you look at like the success of a parent's jumper who played in the NBA and how it might affect the way their kid will perform in the NBA? Like, is there a correlation between that? Because I'd imagine hand-eye coordination, dexterity with your fingers, reaction time, like all of those things are at least partially inherited by our parents. So that's one of the things that I'm weird about and thinking about with the draft right now. Do you think it is, Adam?
I do, man. I'm telling you, it's weirdness too. Like, it's not even one thing. Like, oh, don't get a guy with high hips or this or that. It's just, do they have something that's weird about them? And so it gives them an advantage because you're used to guarding a regular size person, but somebody with extra long forearms or something like gets extra steals. So just my little theory here. Shea, very low hips, very well balanced. I think it helps him.
And OKC likes those weird players. Like Chet's got a weird body. They drafted Poku, who's got a weird body. Like they got a number of guys deep on their roster with weird body types. it's a Poku's long.
It's a roster full of weird bodies.
But I mean, you look at, for example, I mean, even Jalen Williams, very broad shoulders, very, very strange body. AJ Mitchell. Yeah. I mean, they get a lot of guys like that, but they've always drafted those types of guys. And I want to talk, Adam, about big picture stuff because, you know, I wrote an article last week on Yahoo when it comes to the blueprint of these Pacers and Thunder teams. Love you this. Obviously over at DNVR, you cover the Nuggets and have for many, many years. There's different blueprints in the NBA, but do you think there's something to the way OKC and Indiana are both playing with deep rosters, both playing with stars that are surrounded by guys who not only shoot and not only defend, but can do stuff off the dribble? We saw that from Aaron Wiggins tonight with some of the off the dribble stuff that he did. He's not just a 3-and-D player. We see that with Caruso with some of the quick decisions off the dribble he makes. We see that with Indiana's role players as well. Is there something about having no holes and guys who can check all of those boxes? Boston last year was like that as well. Or is this just the way these two teams are built, and it's just one of many championship blueprints that we're going to see in the NBA? What are your overall thoughts and where that kind of league is headed and where it is today?
So I don't believe in a singular blueprint to the game. I think things are evolving and there's always, there's so many different ways to win. That's what makes the NBA great. But there are some non-negotiables, it seems, in today's NBA. I believe the game is getting more technically like smart. I want to say it's not in every single way, just it is a smart game now. When you watch the playoffs, and I think it's one of the reasons Indiana keeps surprising people, even Denver, you know, makes runs. Basketball intelligence is the premium. That's the market inefficiency. So you have to have a smart roster. If you have a smart and versatile roster, game by game, you can change up your game plan. You can adjust in real time to what defenses are throwing at you. Right now, coaches are trying to confuse the other team as much as possible, and teams that get confused or lack the versatility to handle that, then they get stuck in a rut. The teams that are able or are smart enough to say, oh, we know how to guard this coverage, or we know how to attack this coverage and do this or this, those are the teams that seem to advance. Indiana does that on the offensive end. They have a ton of smart players. 3 point guards, first of all, and then you have Siakam, who's like a point forward if he needs to be, and then a bunch of guys that can make the connecting passes, could correct screens, screening angles. The execution is high. And Oklahoma City has this on the defensive end. What they do defensively is not simple. And not just physically it's difficult, but also mentally it's difficult. You have to be able to read things in real time with no hesitation. You have to read what coverage you're in and what that means based on the rotation that you're in. So to me, you can win a lot of different ways. These two teams are very different, but the thing they have in common is that they can roll out a 7-8-9-man rotation in a playoff series, and none of those guys are going to struggle to read what's happening for Indiana offensively, for Oklahoma City defensively. And I just would have a hard time thinking we're going to have a dumb champion in the next like 3 or 4 years.
That's funny. A dumb champion. No, I don't see it. I don't see that happening. The skill level is too high, and these teams have high basketball IQs. And as you said, there's the mental aspect about it as well, not only with thinking the game, but with basketball intelligence, but also just the mental aspect relates to the physical. Being able to sustain that level of intensity from start to finish in these games. Kenny Atkinson, the Cavs head coach, said something interesting after Cleveland was eliminated in 5 games by Indiana. And Kenny was at the podium and he said, like, you know, Indiana plays with a physicality, and they do it from start to finish in these games. And their intensity that they play with, like, we didn't match them mentally. And like hearing him talk about that makes me think about, you know, what we see from Indiana, everything you said about OKC and the way these two teams play and how it relates to the draft, and like who are the guys that are going to be entering the league this year that could play in these games where their speed from start to finish and it's intense and the playoffs are more physical. I think the bar is so high to play at this level right now. And, you know, I know some people say, you know, the league is shallow and it's not ready for expansion. I disagree there. I think the league is still deep with a lot of good talent, but I think the bar has raised so much that it is harder for guys to earn minutes. That makes it feel more shallow. Do you know what I'm saying there, Adam? Does that make sense?
100%. It does. And it's interesting because the Ringer came out with like their top 100 players this week. And as I'm going through it, you get to the like number 5 or 6 and you're like, man, this is kind of shallow. You know, I remember when number 6 or 7 was Kawhi Leonard and James Harden, all this or that. And you're starting to get to like Donovan Mitchell and these types of players there. But then you go to guys 10 through 70 and you get down to like number 55 and you're like, that's a really good player. So it's almost deep in guys that are really smart and can do some things. And obviously, to your point, it does fall off. And so there are teams that I think are towing along a couple players who are very skilled or very athletic or what have you. But can they mentally hang when you get to the conference finals and finals where the game is becoming so sharp and you have to think quick? I agree with you. I think that there are probably, you know, 120 players maybe that fit that bill. And if you are a team like Oklahoma City or Indiana and you have 8 of them, 9 of them, it's like you have the ability now to do this. If you're a team that has 3 or 4, but you've also got some guys, and I think this was part of Denver's problem, to be honest, this year, the team that I cover, was they could play some of the smartest basketball in the NBA when their starting 5 was out there. The moment you started to bring other guys in, it was like, we can't do this because that guy doesn't know how to do it. Or if we give him the ball, he can't keep the offense going, so we have to reset. So, yes, I think that when you look at the draft, it's a no-brainer that you have to look at this and not just say, what does a guy have, but does he fit the prototype of a guy who could play in a complex series like this Indiana-Oklahoma City one?
Adam, I love talking with you, Adam Matas of DNVR and all NBA, but you know who's a opinion I really would love to have on this? It's Michael Jordan.
Let me hear.
Michael Jordan, because... because Michael Jordan,
you're now,
because he's coming back. He's going to NBC next year. And Stephen A. Smith was on Patrick Bet David's podcast, and they were talking about MJ, and he said how MJ is not going to hold back next year on NBC. We'll see. Like, we'll see about MJ. He's been quiet for many, many years, but I just look forward. I just thought about it today. I just look forward to get Michael Jordan's thoughts, if he is indeed unfiltered, if he is indeed saying what's really on his mind about where the game is, who the players in the league are, what he thinks about him. I don't know. I think it'd be pretty fascinating. Are you excited about MJ, or are you more skeptical about what that experience is going to be like with him?
I'm nervous. I'm very nervous about what it's going to look like, to be honest with you, because I love MJ. You know, I'm 41. I'm a little bit older than you. And one of the reasons I was curious to ask you about this is because I'm just curious what the younger people think. Jordan, 98, I was 14 years old. So I was a kid watching Jordan. And the people that are 30, you know, 25, 30 watching the NBA, he's like what Wilt was to me, you know, almost this myth, this thing you didn't even have. And Jordan has been silent for basically 25 years. We haven't heard from him. And I think it adds to his legacy. The Last Dance came out and everybody was like, oh, we get to relearn about this guy in this curated way. How awesome. He seems incredible. But we know when guys are commenting, I mean, we know this, you and I, because we do this for a living. Inevitably, people are going to say something dumb. And MJ, is he like a Shaq who maybe can't help himself but throw a little barb in there, downplay guys that, you know, he doesn't love, who the rest of NBA fans love? I don't know. But I'm more curious, just does MJ have cultural relevancy to people who are south of 35? That's my big question, because this is the most important player in the history of the NBA, at least in my opinion, the most important player coming back to call games. But I'm not sure if the main audience, the biggest demographic that'll be watching him, understands that or even cares.
It's an interesting point. I mean, so I'm 34, right? Like I just missed MJ. I have no recollection of any of the Bulls championships. Zero. It's sad. I wish I was born like 5 years earlier just so I could have experienced it. However, I do think there's some data points that suggest that he still is going to be relevant. Last Dance, the memes, crying Jordan. that stuff has kept him
on Twitter.
That stuff has kept him out there with just silly moments or, you know, serious moments, as we saw in The Last Dance and the way that captured everybody's attention during the pandemic. And so if he's going on NBC, I think people are going to listen. And if he's actually good, I think people are going to care. And maybe he's thinking part of it, like, you know, LeBron's near the end. Time for me to enter the media sphere and have my voice out there to remind people of who I am. And not only am I the GOAT on the court, but I'm the GOAT. Well, you seem really skeptical, Adam.
I'm just nervous, man. You're nervous. I love MJ.
You think he might hurt his legacy by doing this? Is that what you're nervous about?
I think it's hard
about?
To help you. It's hard to help your legacy when you're considered the GOAT, right? There's nowhere to go. So it's really hard for it to be like, oh, he's going to elevate it in this weird way. And here's my thing. And I think it's I have an enormous amount of respect for the old NBA, the 80s and the 90s, the 70s, all the guys that got here. I am of a belief that every player is standing on the shoulder of the giants that came before him, none more so than Michael Jordan. But one of the problems I think the NBA has, and it's nobody's fault, this is a natural thing, it is a game that evolves, and not only does it evolve, but I think the rate of evolution is increasing, meaning the game is more different right now in 2025, you know, even compared to 2015, more so probably than 2015 to 2005, 2005 to 95. Things are changing very rapidly as teams get more information, the world becomes smaller. It's just evolving. And I wonder what MJ's perspective from a league that is now 30 years old. Again, don't hear me wrong. I love MJ. He's my GOAT. But I am curious if he is, how he's going to access this game that is so wildly different from the one that he dominated 30 years ago. And that's my biggest fear. I think Chuck had a hard time with this. I think Shaq had a hard time with this early on in their analysis. And I love Inside the NBA. I'm not one of these guys that hates it. I love that show. It's the biggest influence on me as a person in media. I absolutely love it. But I think they had a hard time. If we remember them saying Golden State Warriors, you can't win shooting jump shots. That was true in 1992. But it wasn't true in 2015 with Steph Curry. The game had changed. And they were slow to understand that. I just hope MJ's not slow to understand how different this game is than the one he played.
I get what you're saying. Like, he just might sound like an old head. He just might sound like he's living in the past. That's what you're saying. Instead of embracing the living. He might have some advice.
Yeah, he's breaking it down in a way where you're like, I don't know if that's the right answer there. MJ, we'll see.
Take 20 mid-range a game early in the clock, caliber, and that's the adjustment for you in game three and beyond. That's what you're worried about. But we'll see. I mean, we'll see. His last decision with the Hornets to draft Brandon Miller over Scoot Henderson is looking good. maybe he'll continue heat checking moving forward as an NBA analyst for NBC. Somebody who is on a heat check right now, it's James Dolan. James Dolan, the New York Knicks owner, he was in the news this week because, according to Vince Goodwill of Yahoo Sports, he spearheaded the firing of Tom Thibodeau. And Vincent reported that Dolan was never a Tibbs fan, that he was the guy asking questions during a meeting, taking a more prominent voice than he has in recent years. And additionally, Vincent reported that a couple players felt Tibbs played starters too many minutes, had an inability to adjust. Now, I say he's on a heat check because he hired Leon Rose. He built the Sphere in Vegas, the best concert venue in the whole world in the history of civilization. So James Dolan's on a heater. But do you think his increased presence back in New York bodes poorly for the Knicks?
I mean, yes, absolutely. I'll be honest, man. You had me in the first half there when you said James Dolan was on a heater. I didn't know you meant the Sphere, but yes, you are right. The Sphere is very cool.
Are you going to join me at Backstreet Boys and Las Vegas Summer League? Are you joining me?
I can't do it, man. I can't do it. The Backstreet, I can't do it, man.
Larger than life. I can't do it. I want it that way. So many hits.
There you go.
Come on,
so many.
Adam.
I mean, you just,
are you too old?
You can keep listing them.
I'm just the right age. I'm the perfect age for the Backstreet Boys.
I think with Dolan, I mean, first of all, I've never been the biggest Tibbs guy. I feel like what you got this year is what you're going to get from Tibbs. If the players were questioning him, to me, that really says it all. Not only so, another personality of the league right now, I think you have to be smart, you have to be versatile, you probably have to be athletic. And I mean, both of these teams have a lot of athleticism in key spots. You also have to be connected. Like, you have to all believe the same thing. And if you're telling me, you know, that some of the players weren't necessarily fully on board with Tibbs's style, then that alone is reason enough to try to move on. I think we all saw that with how they played. But here's the thing. You mentioned A.J. Mitchell playing in game one. A.J. Mitchell closed games for the Thunder when other guys were healthy throughout the year. To me, this is Dagnott's best part about him being of his coaching, is that he seems to understand that in addition to winning 68 games, which is absurd in and of itself, he also knew that you had to prepare in the regular season for things in the playoffs. A lot of times, you know, there were teams like the Cavs, for example, where they did some great things all year and they won a bunch of games. And one of the questions I heard people ask was, yeah, they're really good at what they do, but what do they do if somebody shuts that down or makes that part difficult? What do they do? Have they worked on that all year? Oklahoma City has. The New York Knicks have not. Like, the New York Knicks are the extreme opposite of Oklahoma City. They play their guys. They play them a lot of minutes. They play the same way. They close the same way. And that's who they are. And I think that trade alone maybe is enough to say, we got to build up some of these other guys so that we have more answers when it really matters.
Adam, you're speaking my language. I'm having Chris Mannix on the podcast this week because him and I got into a debate on TV in Boston last week about the Tibbs firing, and him and I have to continue that because he is very much in the firing Tibbs is insane camp, whereas you and I feel exactly the same way about that decision. There was a little bit of other news over this weekend. Cooper Flagg is going to be visiting Dallas for a workout on June 17th. Should he just show up smelling of Slovenian beer?
Some yelling beer, maybe a little rakia, maybe a little hookah, who knows? What a weird situation this has turned into. It was weird enough when they won the pick, right? And all of a sudden it's like, okay, now you were in this win it all, go for it right now. But now you have a young guy. Are you going to be able to manage the two timelines? But now with the Jason Kidd rumors and everything else, it does feel like Dallas is in the ultimate weird spot. So one, no, he should not try to throw his way out of Dallas. He should absolutely try to be in Dallas.
It was a serious two, question.
That's a serious thing. We got to get through the temple. No, but two, when that pick happened, it was like, what a great spot for Cooper Flagg. He's landing in a place where he's going to be able to compete. He'll be on the big stage. That's a big enough market, all those things. And now you look at it, and if they lost Jason Kidd, that'd be a very weird situation, actually, for him to walk into.
So you don't think he should show up like that? Reeking of beer with a hangover, and Nico's just getting flashbacks of Luka? It sounds like a good plan to me.
Is there anything he could do to throw that pick? That would be pretty amazing if he tried the Charles Barkley. Remember the Charles Barkley story where he just was binge eating for a couple of weeks so they would trade him?
Can you imagine if that's what happens, if that's the story on June 17th? Like, we're Cooper gained weight.
They're having bomb second thoughts. Like, oh man, it'd be incredible, man.
I mean, you never know. I it's not going to happen, but it would be very funny if it did happen. Something else I want to talk to you about tonight, Adam, is the presentation of the finals. We didn't talk about this earlier because
I like this.
They put digital trophies on the court after Adam Silver over the weekend was asked about this. And he said, I hadn't thought about it until game one, about how there's really nothing on the floor that signifies that the NBA finals is what you're watching on the screen. Even the score bug on ESPN and ABC doesn't really make it clear that's the NBA finals. There's no big trophy anymore. There's no finals script. And yet tonight in the first quarter, they have the digital trophy and then they change it to the finals script in the second quarter. And then they took it away. I feel like if I'm watching Ice Cube's Big Three League, I'd be disappointed with this level of presentation for the NBA and the NBA finals. Like, what are we doing? Like, what, really?
Yeah. It's weird too, because Adam Silver, you know, he is the champion of the in-season tournament courts. It's not like he doesn't understand the idea of that. I mean, pageantry in general from the NBA, I think, has taken a big hit over the last 15, 20 years. But these little things to me really give you a peer into the ideas man, Adam Silver, who I'll be full disclosure, not the biggest fan of Adam Silver. He bothers me more than almost anyone in the NBA. But to me, when they went to for between game one and then doing this
with anyone in life, I thought you were where you were going. Anyone, dot, dot, dot.
Just because I love basketball, I love basketball and I love the NBA. People always ask me about my biases and where it is. It's like, I love this game. I know it's cool to talk about how ratings don't matter. And look, if you don't care about ratings, I get it. I care about them because I love this game and I want it to be like something we share as like a society, as a global society, this thing that we share. So the pageantry of it is important. But what this tells me is he didn't have it on the court. He said, I never thought of it. Okay, that's a big L. Let's put that in a box to the side. But then to go and put this one on, then you read the Twitter timeline, everyone's making fun of it, and then to change it to the script and then to take it off. I think the commissioner's too online. And I think the commissioner looks at social media feedback way too much. Players do this sometimes. I think media members do this sometimes. Social media is not the truth. And for them to change this three times throughout the course of one finals game to me is, that is almost worse than them trying it, was the fact that they kept changing it, trying to see like, do you guys like this? What about this? Is this what you want?
Adam, the NBA is too online and they do monitor what people say. It's a fact. It's a fact.
Of course.
Like, it's just the truth that it happens. Like, 5 or 6 years ago, I remember tweeting during a game about how the NBA TV feed, they scrunched the aspect ratio when they brought up the score bug at the bottom. And I put that out there, and the next game it was fixed. And somebody from the league office texted me saying, like, thank you for pointing that out. Like, it helped get conversations started, like, that we need to fix this.
Oh, man.
And so, like, they're like, that's personal evidence that I've experienced, that they do monitor what people say. And the thing that confuses me here, Adam, is that this isn't new with people talking about, oh, where's the introductions? Right. Where's the theatrics before games? Like, why aren't we seeing the national anthem? So it's not the first year that it's been like this. And yet this is the year, for some reason, that we're seeing some of these strange changes actually happening and Adam Silver actually talking about it in front of people. But this has been happening, as you said, for many, many years at this point. I hope to God, with NBC and Amazon, I hope their broadcasts are 10 out of 10. I hope they are amazing broadcasts, and it really pushes ESPN to elevate in the way that they can. Like, ESPN does a great job with the NFL with their broadcast there. And I think with the NBA side of things, there's plenty of good things. And I think this is like, there's some of these areas making you feel like you're there and making the game feel like it's big and feel like it's important.
Right.
That's one of the things that the finals is missing right now. And I hope that we can get that back.
it's the game is what's important. And it's almost like they've lost the sense of why these games feel like they mean something. At the end of the day, it is just shooty hoop, right? Guys, against your guys running around, throwing a ball into a cylinder. But what makes it big and feel important? It feels like the NBA, and especially in my opinion, not to throw anybody under the bus, but ESPN in particular has lost sight of what makes these things interesting. And I'll give you the perfect example. If you remember about the social media aspect of this and how you can over-index on it, do you remember Mr. Beast at the All-Star game this yeah. year?
Yep.
It did that dumb bit that seemed like it took forever. It made for horrible television. It didn't make any sense, and it took forever, and it took away from the game. And that thing did millions of views on social because you can cut it into this like package thing, and then it looked like it was cooler than what it actually was, and all these people consumed it that way. And I think the NBA would look at that and say, oh, that was a success. It's like, no, that was a horrible moment of a broadcast of a show, and it was a good social media post, but those two things are in conflict with each other. That's kind of how I view all of NBA presentation of all of the games and the broadcasts. They just feel like, what is this for? Because if it's about the broadcast and nothing else, you're doing a really bad job.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing for the NBA to juggle, because on one hand, I agree, like, you know, if you don't know who Mr. Beast is, first of all, you're like, huh, what is this? Who is this? It's just confusing for a percentage of the viewership. And even if you do know who Mr. Beast is, maybe that doesn't need to be there for All-Star Weekend. On the other hand, Mr. Beast had that Damian Lillard moment as part of a YouTube video that published 2 weeks ago that got 115 million views and had Giannis in it, had Steph in it, had Neymar in it, had a bunch of legendary athletes. It was the video was beat Neymar, win $500,000, and where normal people would compete against athletes and win money like that kid did against Damian Lillard in the shootout. So on one hand, the NBA is getting significant exposure from the biggest YouTuber on the planet. On the other hand, it comes at the cost of possibly hurting your broadcast of All-Star Weekend, which was overall disaster. Like, all of it was a disaster with Kevin Hart and everything like that. It was all bad. But like, yeah. I watch Mr. Beast personally. I don't know. Like, maybe I don't know.
I've watched him. I'm not a hater by any means. I appreciate it.
I very much enjoy Mr. Beast. I watch every single one of his videos. It's just the honest truth. I think he's very entertaining. I think he does a great job putting together like these game show style videos, and they're fun to watch. They go by quickly, but it's difficult, to your point, for the NBA, where they have one foot and needing to create the best broadcast possible, and another foot and worrying about social media clips. And that's the underlying point that you're hitting here, where it's true with the big examples of a Mr. Beast, where there is a lot of benefit there, but also true with just really everything on any day, on any random game on a Monday or a Thursday, where that's sometimes the stuff they're worrying about, instead of just making people feel like they need to tune in for the game live and being there live. And on that note, Adam, like, I feel the NBA, like, when they say, like, when, like, you get pushback, like, oh, the ratings are not worried about the TV ratings and all that, and they talk about their social media ratings. Like, how often does the NBA put out, like, oh, our social media ratings are up X percent all the time? Clearly, the league cares about it, or at least they're acting like they care about it. So I don't know if that matters. I don't know if that matters. But bottom line, though, is I'm with you. I do care about the ratings because I want people to be consuming these games live, because it's an unbelievable game and the game's in a great spot right now. So I hope ratings can increase. And then whatever the factors are that lead to that, whether it's Mr. Beast viewers starting to watch basketball games because Stephen, Damian Lillard, or Giannis are in there, or whether it's because Michael Jordan's as a analyst on NBC, I don't care. Just as long as people are watching basketball. If it's people listening to Adam and Legs with all NBA, great. It doesn't matter. I just want people to watch the game.
And enjoy it. You know, watch it and enjoy the game and all the other stuff that comes with it. You can pick and choose which parts you enjoy. I don't enjoy all parts of the surrounding of the NBA, but I do enjoy the game so much, especially when it is presented well. And by the way, this is why I have strong takes about things like fouling up three, not because I don't understand that it's strategically smart. I just look at it and say, yeah, but people aren't going to like the game if that happens. We need to make a product that is true to the spirit of the game that people really enjoy to watch. And like I said, there's some momentum in the wrong direction, but it's not the fault of the players, or because I think there's some phenomenal teams. It's a great era of team basketball right now, which is, I think, at its heart, what basketball is about. It's this great collection of individualism and collectivism. We're at a really good point right now where Oklahoma City, Indiana, they play great team basketball and they're rewarded for it. So I just want people to enjoy it the way I do. And you know, maybe people don't. Maybe people enjoy something else and I'm going to be the odd man out. But I think people would enjoy the best of what I enjoy about it.
Well, last thing before I let you go, Anthony Smith in the YouTube chat. Hilton Armstrong is the long-necked UConn player.
That's right. Look him up.
Hilton Armstrong.
He's like a 6'5" guy, but his neck made him 7 feet. So everyone's like, oh, he's a center.
Yeah, Hilton Armstrong. Yeah, he spent 6 years in the NBA, listed at 6'11".
There you go. But he's got like my build, you know? He's like basically my height.
Hey, you're tall. You're a baller. You are a baller. Every year at these NBA events, you're always crushing. You're like Jokic out there on the floor from what I hear, Adam.
I'm too old now, man. I'm too old. I just wish I had a longer neck. Could have been in the NBA.
Legs had a great story about you on the podcast as a player. I remember correctly, a couple months back, where he didn't know, and then he realized, whoa, this Adam guy's actually really good.
I got to live on this reputation, man, because I'm too old to prove it anymore. So I got to just live on these old stories.
Adam, where can people find your stuff with Tim Legler and your All NBA and DVR everywhere? You're everywhere. Where can people find your stuff?
Just the All NBA show. If you're an NBA fan, me and Tim Legler, we go live 4 times a week. It's mostly just me asking Legs what he sees and learning from him. Yeah, he's such a good analyst, and I'm thankful every day I get to talk to hoop with him.
We'll be back again on Tuesday morning. I got Caitlin Cooper talking Pacers, talking Thunder. Looking forward to that conversation with her. Also talking with Chris Mannix as well for that show. That's on Tuesday. Big thank you to Adam Mattes for joining me tonight on this Sunday after OKC beat the Pacers 1-1. Can't wait. Can't wait for game 3 later in the week. We had a lot of pods coming this week, talking draft as well later in the week. I look forward to that. Thank you to Mike, everybody on the team for producing. Thank you so much for producing today's show. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again. Talk soon.